Okay. Well, thank you, Mary, for meeting with me today. My name is Anjali Grantham. I'm here with Mary Brown. It's June 11th, 2018, and we're at the Bristol Bay Historical Society's Museum in Naknek, Alaska. And this interview is taking part as a portion of the NN Cannery History Project. So, Mary, if you could begin just by introducing yourself, tell us your name, where you're from, and kind of just basic facts like that.
I'm Mary Brown, and I grew up in Blaine, Washington. My dad was in the service, so we ended up there. That was the last place he was stationed. And I got there when I was 8 years old. I was born in Japan, and lived over on the East Coast numerous years, and then we came to Blaine, and then we settled there, and that's where he retired. And that's where I graduated from high school. And after high school, I started coming up to Alaska. And there's a big Alaska Packers plant at Semiahmoo Spit, and I went there and applied for a job. And I was working at Denny's at the time. And me and my girlfriend decided to go sign up, and because numerous kids at the school said they made lots of money to at the cannery, so they all traveled. So rumor has it that's what it was. So during the summer, we got hired in July, and we ended up going to Larson Bay. And that's where it started. As I started as a Slimer, my girlfriend, she worked in the egg house, so it was interesting. It was only 3 weeks long. It was towards the end of the season. And it was quite a eye opener for a person that has been living in Blaine for a long time. So,
What year was it that you got your start?
oh, 1976.
And that was the year you graduated from high
Yes.
school then? So what was thinking about growing up in Blaine?
Got a mic.
Oh, thank you. Growing up in Blaine and having the APA cannery there, what sort of reputation or what sort of what do people think about being a cannery worker when in Blaine when you were growing up? Do you
You
know?
know, I really never hung out with any of the cannery people over there because that was on the other side of the spit. It was over in town. I lived right across from the high school after my dad retired from the base when I was like 12. And so I don't really have too much recollection. I'm pretty sure that Sylvia Mativier was the one that interviewed me or hired me or took my application anyway. But I got to know her real well from working in the office. And she also worked at the Blaine office, her and her husband. So, but I didn't have too much communication with, in fact, I didn't have any communication other than hearing stuff from the kids, from school. But my mom did work there off and on. When the cans come from Alaska on the tender, they bring it to to the Semiahmoo plant, and they go through the dented cans before it got labeled. So she would help when they needed her, But mostly she was just a part, not part-time, just, seasonal or whatever they needed. So.
So did you think that you were going to be working in Blaine when you went to the office to get hired, or were you hoping to be sent to
Oh, I
Alaska?
was hoping to be sent to Alaska because I never traveled. When I was a kid, my dad pretty much drove everywhere. We moved from New York to California. We drove. And he wasn't into planes or anything like that. So, and then the only time we flew was from Japan. So I'd never been really on a plane after that, that I could remember. So it was an adventure. My first plane ride was coming up from Seattle to Anchorage, and then in a big plane, like I don't know what it was, a seven, it must have been a 747 or something like that. Then it got into a smaller plane in Anchorage to Kingstown. Then we got into a float plane, one of those gooses. Never had any idea we'd be doing all that to get to Larsen Bay.
So you flew to King Salmon to get to Larsen
Oh,
Bay.
no, I'm sorry, not King Salmon. Wait a minute. Was it King Salmon? We had to have. No, we flew to Kodiak.
Okay,
Sorry.
okay.
Foodicolia.
I was like, that's a really interesting trip to.
Yeah.
To try to make
no, but we did, you know, Pan Air did have a goose, but, you know, yeah. But we used to do that too when I worked at Pan Air. We used to fly over to Kodiak.
So were you a union member then?
Yes. I did join the union, and they had a sign up at the Local 37. And I don't recall too much after that. I mean, as I remember when I went to Uganic 2 years later, I remember they gave us money for travel, you know, like $100 in case we get stuck somewhere. We have some cash. And just signing up, you know, and also you have your rights, you know, if you're of Oriental descent or anything like that, then you're allowed to eat in a different mess hall if you like, you know, because you're supposed to have your rice. I'm not sure if it's twice a day or three times a day, something like that. So anyway, so but other than that, that's all I remember is going to Seattle and hurry up, come back.
I see. So you went to Seattle to get our
tickets and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And was that also the first year when you went to Larsen Bay? Were you a member of the union, or was it
too late
in the season?
It was, I remember being in the union, but I don't recall going to the union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they just probably made us sign all the papers when we got up here, you know, but, it was all so new, and everything was, I mean, it was like being a tourist, you know, fly into this place and land on this little spit, and there's this old, you know, hill in between the cannery and the spit and the, you know, anyway, there was a big old graveyard where they either drowned or not really sure how they, you know. But I know I have pictures somewhere.
Frenchies, I think they call it Frenchies.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Or something like that.
Yeah, and it's a cute little village, Larsen Bay was. I remember walking all along the beaches, and beautiful beaches and stuff, and people were all real nice. And we had the cannery store and the mess hall and the different houses, and we lived in the Ritz. And also there was a Hilton, and there was a few other ones, but I don't recall all of them. But old bunkhouses, you know. And
was Larsen Bay segregated still?
It was. You know, I don't really recall a segregation. I remember all the fishermen. I didn't see too many, you know, Filipinos or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all pretty much kids.
Mm, you know. Mm-hmm. So just the one mess hall to feed everyone.
Yep.
And so after that first summer of sliming, what was it that inspired you to continue with cannery work?
Well, the money did. That was one thing. We didn't work long hours because it was towards the end of the season. We had a couple days, you know, one day off. You got paid 8 hours a day, and then anything after 8 hours was your own overtime, you know, that was attached. And if the season wasn't good, they still guaranteed you, I think it was $2,000. So, but I still made over that, and even with not a lot of overtime. And it was fun. We had a good time. And me and my girlfriend I went to school with, I found out another girlfriend signed up, so we ended up splitting because she was in the egg house and we were all both in the slimers, you know, so it was different schedules, so she would be off later, and so it was kind of a conflict of sleeping and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So that after that first short season, you went back to Blaine then? Or
yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And then and then immediately started thinking about doing Alaska again?
Yeah, well, what I do is I'd go home and I'd either, let's see, what did I do after that? I went to a fashion merchandising college. Talked into that. One of my friends did. So I went to that, and on 77, well, when springtime starts happening, I say, well, I start calling the canneries, ask them if they would send you up for free, you know, housing and food is taken care of, and how much guaranteed, you know, how much work. And if all those things were answered right, then I'd you know, go check them out and put my application in. So the next year in 77, I went to Dutch Harbor and then did the crab season, Tanner crab and shrimp. And then September came around and I didn't want to stay a couple more months. It was a 6-month contract. And I broke my contract. Usually I don't quit, but there was a lot of things going on there and I wanted to go. You know, there was stabbings and just, you know, the employee foreman kind of interaction I didn't like. There was, back in those days, a lot of the girls would go be ladies of the night, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, it was really a wild and woolly place back then, and the Elba Room. So it was really crazy. Mm-hmm. But still, all in all, I went back a long time after they built the bridge and everything, and I trying to recall the paths that I would take, and because we lived, everything was processed on the ship that was docked, you know, mm-hmm. but we live on land, mm-hmm. but there's still bunks in the ship for people, but we lived in a co-ed type of dorm mm-hmm. thing.
But, and was that a crab cannery?
Or yeah, okay. Vita Seafoods, mm-hmm. and they processed Tanner crab. They'd either brine them in raw after they butchered them, or they would cook them, and then they'd shrink wrap them. That's what we used to do. Was after they got cooked, they were in these huge cages, and they would bring them over and cool them, and then we'd have to take them. You know, the crabs have these little lips after the top shell got popped off, so you grab them by the lip and rip the lip off and throw them in the washer because they always have that green slimy stuff over it. Or anyway, so that go through the washer, then it'd go lined up on a little conveyor, and if there's any legs missing, everybody had all these missing legs, you know. They fit it in there, and then it'd get into a little shrink wrap thing and off to the freezer, you know, after it got shrink wrapped, labeled everything, ready to go. And then if they didn't do that, a lot of the stuff would get down into another hold down below in the next floor, and we would throw all the crab down there, and then it'd be in these big, huge troughs of icy water, and you'd grab the, I remember going there, and you'd stand in front of a blade, and you just sit there and cut them all out and get the meat out of it. Oh. And then they pack whole boxes of meat. It was really good, and I ate lots.
So in that whole process, what was your job?
Well, they had you do everything, pretty much. When I first started there, they put me in a smaller ship called Viceroy, and we did Tanner crab. We did fish a lot. Some you had to be in a black light, and there's, you know, all sorts of, there's worms, stuff, mm-hmm. you know. So you pick them out and all that, and before they got processed, after they've got filleted, got to go through the black light, pick all them out. So, and then I don't remember doing any crab there. I didn't stay very long there because my girlfriend was on the big ship, which was, they're kind of tied in, but this group was a little more relaxed than this group over here. And I liked it being down there, but I moved over here, and it was a little more rowdier over here. And a lot more interaction with Koreans and Chinese and East Indians and stuff like that. There was everybody.
The other processing workers?
Yes, yeah.
Were most people being recruited out of Seattle for that sort of work too? Or
yeah, that's where I got my job, was in mm-hmm. Seattle. Mm-hmm. So I got the job. But, I never met anybody from there. You know, I met everybody when we got there. And my girlfriend was already there because mm-hmm. I was still trying to finish school. Mm-hmm. So I never did get my paperwork from the school, mm-hmm. you know, because I left early. So, and anyway, when I come back in the fall time, I usually go look for a job down in Bellingham or something. And then when springtime comes around, there I go again, you know. do the same process. So the next year in 1978, I went to Euganic Bay and worked for New England Fish Company. And then I packed eggs. And that was a very long season for me. And I ended up getting pretty sick at the end. I found out I had mono. And I didn't get better. Once I got home, I got on the first plane. I asked the foreman if I could leave, and she said, on the first plane. And she said, no problem. But it was from June to through almost the end of August. And towards the end, I was feeling pretty bad. So I got mono, and I didn't recover until almost December. So it was that bad.
Wow.
And so I had a hard time. I didn't want to go leave the house, you know, because I'd been so sick. And I lost about 20 pounds, and that was no fun. I didn't like that one. Mm-hmm. I never heard of it. And there's no shots. You have to sleep, and that's all you do is sleep. Mm-hmm. And you can't eat. You can't hold nothing down. It's weird. It's just constant rejection, you know. So it just took a long process to get back on outside there.
And so that was 1978?
78.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Was Euganic, was that still segregated in 78 when yes. you were there?
Uh-huh.
Could you describe that?
Well, all I know is that I don't know necessarily know if they had a Filipino bunkhouse like they did over in South Naknek, but the mess hall was segregated. So if I didn't like what was going on over here at the, what we called it, the machinist's mess hall, then I'd go over there. But usually I'd go over like a mug up at night because they'd always have leftover stuff. And you walk in and the smells are so different, you know, than in the other mess hall. But still, all the food was good.
What was the difference in food?
Oh, just, you know, the rice, the way they prepare it. And then they eat lots of pickles. And some of them are pretty stinky, but they may smell stinky, but they taste really good. Mm-hmm. so it's just like the stuff I eat at home with my mom, you know.
Was everyone welcome to go to whichever mess hall?
No, you had to be, they didn't want everybody there. They want, if you were of Oriental descent, you know, they said, I'm allowed to do that. And mm-hmm. so they okayed me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So
were other Filipinos or Japanese people or other Asians allowed to go to the mechanics mess hall to eat? Or
you know, was I just didn't see too many. Road? It was one way for me, but I didn't see too many over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's mostly over there.
Mm-hmm.
They stayed over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where I met that Silmi Domingo, and then. He was always watching over the Filipinos, make sure, you know, everything was going okay. Mm-hmm. But they were all cannery people because I worked in the egg house, so it was mostly girls and the Japanese. And we had two companies, and I can't remember who the second, I remember Toshoku, and I'm not really sure what the other one was. But they were, one group of Japanese were very nice, but the other group was mean and kind of made your job hard, you know, and picked on people. So we picked on them a couple times, and some of the things we did, probably I shouldn't say, but we put things in there. So this is off the record.
Well, don't worry about it then. You mentioned that you said she when you were talking about a foreman.
Oh yeah, it was a girl. She okay. was a, yeah, which was the first time I've seen. Girl foreman.
Yeah. And
you know.
Was she foreman of the egg house or?
She was a foreman, kind of the overall head foreman, because mm-hmm. kind of looked over everybody. So it wasn't a really big plant because, you know, it's just right up against the mountain. But it was fun. We had a good time there.
Do you remember the name of the foreman?
No, I don't.
It's really interesting because I don't think I've ever heard before of a female foreman at that time.
Yeah, that's, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, over at Alaska Packers, there was numerous foremans.
Mm-hmm.
But they made the hospital into a girls' foreman shack for the women.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was later. That wasn't right when I got there. Because
mm-hmm.
the hospital was the hospital when I was there for mm-hmm. the first couple years. Well, the first year. The second year, it ended up being the bookkeeper's house because he had numerous dogs. He brought these Lhasa Apsas and his wife. And it was a very interesting bookkeeper. Her name's Saida, was his wife's name. So she said, when she introduces herself, she says, "Hi, my name's Saida," you know, like Saida Beef. and I go, "Oh my goodness." But they were particular about people cleaning their room. So after a while, I was the only one that was allowed to go in there. Mm-hmm. And then after that, he didn't come back after that year. And so they ended up making that into a foreman shack. Mm. It never became a hospital after that. Okay. The first year was interesting because we had a nurse, almost like a MASH nurse type of thing, you know, like MASH. She dressed like that, you know. And I remember picking up people, you know, taking them to the airport from the clinic and stuff. And one guy, I remember, from PAF, they brought him over. And she checked him out, and he had cut his fingers off with the saw, the radial arm saw. And so then all the fingers were in the bag, and we'd taken them. He says, "I knew I was going to do that again." So he had done it before, which was really strange. I was like, okay. But that was one incident. One time, the kids we were cruising around the dock, the clinic, the health aide came and got me, and we were looking for kids, and they were all over around the dock area in the cannery. Couldn't figure out what happened, but they got into something, and they were passed out everywhere. You know, one was passed out in between the fish house, the screen door, you know, the screen door was open, but he's just right there. And I can't recall where we picked up the other ones, but they were here and there, and then we picked them all up, and then the health aide, went and said something in Yupik, and those kids looked straight up and sat straight up, and they didn't say a word. So I don't know what she's told them, but she, you know, they knew they were in big trouble.
They were cannery workers?
No, they weren't. They were just some kids in the village. Mm. They weren't cannery workers. They were probably not even, you know, 16. Mm. You know, a lot of them were under that. Mm. So
what happened? You got mono. You left Uganic.
Right.
What happened to bring you to
Bristol Bay? Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. It's 70. My girlfriends were all going to Western. And... Mm. I went to, which is Western Washington, you know, in Bellingham. And so I went to a party and I met this guy who goes to Alaska. he was on the Lois. He got me, you know, he told me to apply. So in 79, I had a pretty good job in Blaine working at this podiatry place. And after I got the mono, you know, and I got numerous raises, and I did finish work for orthotics and stuff. They had, that was, there was only two in the U.S., and one was in Blaine that made all these things. So we'd get tons of stuff from all the different foot doctors, and they'd make casts, and then we'd make different things to apply to the person's needs, you know. Some were even stub feet, heel spurs, that kind of stuff, you know. So anyway, I got my job. I applied at Alaska Packers, and I don't even know if I talked to Gary, but I know I remember going to the office, and then in Seattle, and then they flew me up, and they never told me that once I got to King Salmon that I had to take another plane. So the only plane that I was used to going on was Kodiak Western, because from Kodiak, you know. And so I went over to Kodiak, and he says, "Oh, no, you don't want to go with me. You have to go with Penn Air." So I had to take my bags over to Penn Air. And then I get over there, and they flew me in, dropped me off. And it always seems like it's dinner time or something, some kind of meal time. And a van came out, looked at me, and left. I go, well, I don't know where to go. You know, I'm here in the middle of the runway, you know, in this little shack, and the road wise down the way because I looked. And I says, well, I don't know which way to go. You know, they didn't tell me anything. Back in those days, no phones, no cell phones, no nothing. So I waited, and then that van came back again and picked me up. And that's when I started in the office. They took me to the bunkhouse, girls' bunkhouse, and got me in there and set up, and then I went to work in the office. And my main job was to be the airport. But the way the planes ran, I was never there to be a receptionist, very rarely. And also at that time, my boyfriend was out in the hook on the tender, and Bill, my husband that I met up there, he was a carpenter, and he was remodeling the office. And so we got to know each other that way. That's how I met him. And they used to have daiquiri parties. So he invited me to a daiquiri party. And that's where it all started.
What year was that?
That was in 1979.
That was your first year in South Naknek.
Yep.
And did you know that you were going to be working in the office? Is that the job you applied for?
Yes. Well, it was a receptionist.
Okay.
That's what it was for. Mm-hmm. But they didn't tell me I was going to be driving, you know. And it was that was a very main part of my job was that and the mail. I handled all the mail for the company. So I took the outgoing mail to the post office and when we had a full crew on there, it'd be a couple hours in the morning. You know, I'd have all the letters and stuff, but I'd also have cans that were going to the to get tested. You know, the for quality control. So I had numerous boxes of canned salmon, and that would go out. And then in the later in the afternoon, before they closed, I had it took a couple hours because I had lots of packages. And then I take the van and I deliver the mail to the office and then go back down to the cannery and put all the mail in that little mail room. And then if anybody had packages, then I had to write little package slips. And it got to be a little hard to deal because it was a small office. All the packages were, cluttering. And so after a couple of, '80, they moved me to the laundry. And then I could stack my packages on a shelf and people could come there and not be too interfering with the other office work,
I see.
So it worked out better that way.
So you would go to the South Naknek post office to pick up all the mail
right.
for the cannery?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the cannery's address?
Oh, gosh. 264? Box 264, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. And so there'd be... hundreds of letters probably a day, huh?
Bags, mm-hmm. I've had bags of letters.
How would you sort it? By bunkhouse? By alphabetical order? How would you deal with this bulk of mail?
Boy, I tell you, I just grab them and just A, B, C, that way, their last name.
Okay, and so people would come up then and know their name and you'd be able to give them a letter? Or how?
They had in that one bunkhouse that used to be the old office, I assume, because it was a big building just off before the White House. And there was a little mail room, and then there's a office type of building. They never used it. It was just storage and stuff. And then underneath was a warm room, they called it, I think it was. And that's, they stick all their stuff that they didn't want to freeze, and they kept it. It was like really super insulated. So all the radios would go down there and stuff like that. But they had just the big mailbox, open boxes with the A through Z, and you could post notes if you wanted to on the walls and stuff. There was plenty of room for that. It was just walk in, and there's the boxes.
I see. And so it's like A is a box, B is a box,
right.
C is a box.
Right.
And so people come in and they go to their last name.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty basic. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, nobody stole your mail, usually.
And then did you have a second, and then you had a place for packages,
right,
too.
Right.
So then when you moved to the laundry, you just can't keep the packages in the laundry and people continued to go to the post office for their...
Yeah, okay. For their letters, yes.
That's interesting. Good to know. So tell me about your first perceptions of the cannery that first summer. What do you remember about how it looked, how it felt, how it smelled or sounds? I mean, what comes to mind from that summer?
Well, you know, when they first start that generator house, you know, to get everything going for the cannery, it's loud. And when you walk around it, it's also loud. But it just blends into the area, and you don't really realize it until when they turn it off and everybody's going home that it's really quiet, you know, and it's hard to get used to. But all the hubbub and all the people and the boats, you know, going back and forth on the water, and it was very interesting, and lots of Italians, and they're all, you know, talking loud, and I remember good food, lots of good food they make. They made this some kind of a thing they put on the steaks. It's almost like a chimichurri or something they call it, and God, it was good. And this guy named Rooster, what was his last name? I think his son still fish over on this side. I can't recall the last name, but I'll think of it. Mm-hmm. But they would make it. And we've had all sorts of different Italian things to eat before. One time we had pizza. They made a French bread dough, and they put it in one of those electric skillets with just a tomato sauce, and they had salted salmon and chopped garlic and cheese, Parmesan cheese, and oregano, I think it was. And they, you know, did it in layers, and then after that, oh my gosh.
That was served in the mess hall?
No, huh? We had that in the bunkhouse.
Okay.
You know, in the fisherman's bunkhouse.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I'd be hanging out with my husband. He lives in the fisherman's bunkhouse. He's part-time, he was carpenter, part, you know, after a certain time, he got ready for fishing. Mm-hmm. So his dad and his brother, his dad has had his own room, and his brother lived with him. So
where did you live that first summer?
In the girls' bunkhouse.
Okay.
And that's a separate one over there by the Winter Watchman house.
How many girls were in a room, or how many women and how many women in a bunkhouse?
Four rooms, you know, but it was a big room. Okay. And the first year I was with a waitress. And I don't recall having anybody else, just me and her. And then her name was Roseanne. And then the other one, or Roxanne, Roseanne. And then one year I remember there was a couple other gals from Blaine, and I went to school with, but they were younger. They came up and worked in the kitchen and stuff. And so we all lived together in the room there. Mm-hmm. So there was four of us there. It was fun though.
And how many women do you think were in the bunkhouse in total?
Oh, gosh. There was a lot of them. Because every room had at least two to four. Mm-hmm. So, and there's, gosh, I'd say at least 10, 12 rooms. It was full. And then they had, other bunkhouses had like one story was the, you know, one floor level was the girls and the upstairs with the boys or vice versa, something like that. Mm-hmm. But most of the girls lived all in that girls' bunkhouse.
Those first years, what was the, was it like a ratio of men to women that was about the same as far as
no.
the cannery crew, or would you say that was?
I'd say maybe a fifth, you know. So girls were a commodity. You know, and so when I got there, it was just me and the bookkeeper for probably at least a couple weeks, you know. So
because it was early in the year?
Early, okay. Yeah. It was it was May. Mm-hmm. So nobody usually started to show up till mid-May or closer to June when they get ready for the cannery. But and then you've got your kitchen crew. But sometimes the kitchen crew has their own rooms in the back, depending on who it was. I can't recall who the kitchen crew was back then. But I know Becky, my friend that lives here in Natick, she was worked in the kitchen at one time.
Becky
Saville. Well, Catherine back then. Catherine. Anyway, she worked there, but she was also a machinist at one point, too. I'd seen her in coveralls working in the cannery with the cans, the canning machines. So, but I never wandered up through that machinery stuff when they were busy because it was so noisy and everybody so busy, and I was so busy because I was always at the airport, it seemed like, you know. So,
what sort of jobs were, when you were thinking about 79, you said like 1/5 or so of the employees were women. What were the women jobs?
Well, like I said, the kitchen, the cannery, when you load lids, or when the fish come into the cans and they put extra fish in there to bring to weight. Those gals did that. I rarely saw men in there. And then, let's see. And then, of course, Slimers and the egg house. Mostly egg house would be women. I've never seen a guy pack eggs.
Why is that?
I don't know. Maybe the Japanese prefer it that way. It's hard to say. But they had a really nice Japanese foreman that could speak English. He was from Santa Barbara, but he became a really good friend of mine, Yuke. And he even came up to Blaine to see us. So,
what was his full name? Do you remember?
Yuke Iwata, and he was great. He was so nice, and he made visiting with him and the cannery, being in the cannery, a lot easier to deal with, you know, when you have problems or anything. But it was fun. We had good visits.
What were the office jobs?
The office jobs was there was the fish clerk, the bookkeeper. There was another bookkeeper. Well, the fish clerk and the one did tickets, and then the other one did the settlements, and that was Sylvia. Sylvia Mativier did the settlements with the fishermen. And then the one gal that I worked with, she did books, and it's just invoice stuff, you know, and all that other stuff that they have to log in. And then they had another guy that was the main money man, I would assume. And that was like that one year that I had to clean their rooms. Hang on.
Okay, sorry.
Okay.
So you mentioned also that Gary Johnson, the superintendent, was in the office, and so
yes.
That wasn't recording just for that moment.
Okay.
So since you pick people up from the airport, were you kind of like the intake person in a way? Like you would, when someone arrived at the cannery, what did they do? What was the...
Oh, well, the protocol, I guess you'd say, is I'd bring them to the office. They would check in. There'd always be paperwork. If they were an employee, of course, they had all that, you know, W-4s or whatever, unless they filled them out in Seattle. But, and the fishermen all had, you know, their fisherman packet, which had, like, their lease, you know, their boat storage information, their bunk rooms, all that kind of stuff. And they also had invoices that if they ordered through the company, all that stuff would be all in that file for each boat, and all their charges got in there and stuff. And usually by the time they got their insurance and all that paperwork, they were already in debt about 10 grand, you know, when they first hit that place. And then after a while, over the years, they used to eat for free, but then they started making them pay. So it was a little different at the beginning because they wanted them to pay for everything. But then after that, it just became meal tickets just for meals. And the bunk, if they could eat mug up. They were trying to get them to pay for mug up at one point, too. So, but they got that all strained out. But it's changed. They used to feed them on the tenders, I heard. You know, you could go and deliver fish and, you know, use their facilities and even wash clothes or have a meal. But Not anymore.
So these fishermen then were independent fishermen. They weren't necessarily company fishermen by then.
They were in a sense, but they weren't, you know, unlike now where they got, some of them have loyalty programs where you stick with them, and because of the cash buyers back then, if you went to the cash buyers, then you got no loyalty bonus. And sometimes, a lot of times, they'll make you leave, you know, because you're not loyal to the company. So it made a lot of tension because the cash buyers sometimes were fishing or buying fish right at the very first of the season. And a lot of times the cannery, you come to the cannery, well, a lot of times you don't have a lot of money in the springtime because you've bought your nets and all that kind of stuff. So they want to go to the cash buyer just so they can have some cash. And the companies look down on that. Mm-hmm. But they were there for a short amount of time, got the fish first, and left when they got their quota. And then the rest of the season is still plenty of fish. And then in the fall time, when the canneries would quit fishing, accepting fish, then the cash buyers would come back sometimes then and buy the fall fish. Mm-hmm. And they can make more money that way. Mm-hmm. And so my husband did that a lot of times. Mm.
What was a day in the life of Mary back in 1979, 1980?
It was hectic because, you start at 8 o'clock, but the plane never stopped buzzing the cannery. It was all day meals. I mean, I've even had it, well, later on in life, in the season or years, it was 3 o'clock in the morning sometimes. And, no warning, you don't think about it. I'm going, no way, I'm not going out there. Nobody said I had to go out there at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you don't know. And sometimes they just fly over low. So you never know. But back in those days, it was all through meals, everything. I dumped many meals because it seemed like they always come that. Because there's no phones. That was their only signal. And even really back then, buzzing the cannery was looked down upon because it's not really a FAA rule about doing that kind of stuff. But that was the only signal we could, they could get to where you knew there was going to be somebody out there for you. But there was a lot of people out there all the time. Mm-hmm. And I went out there, at least 10 times a day, but it's only a mile out to the airport.
And this is the new airstrip?
No, it was the main airstrip, which is right on the main runway. And that's where that little shack was on the main runway.
The same place that we land now?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's on the main, where you land. That one. There's a cross strip now,
okay,
but there was only one runway, and that was right, that one long one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this isn't the one that's up a hill a bit from the cannery where they have an old winter watchman shack by the dry scows? It seems like there might be a...
There was a foreman shack up there they called the Love's Nest. Mm. And that was the main outside foreman. That was Sylvia's husband's. And Sylvia and her husband lived there. Mm-hmm. And he was the outside foreman, Robert Mativier. And they lived on up above there. And back then, there was a runway right there at the cannery. Every cannery had a runway. Mm-hmm. And
that was the one that you would drive to?
No, huh?
Oh, okay.
No, this one was the main one.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they started filling up all their extra stuff, equipment and all that kind of stuff, started going, and then it became the boneyard, they called it. Okay. So, but I did see one plane land there, and I seen some planes land below the cannery on the beach, which was interesting.
What's the outside foreman?
He oversees the whole cannery.
Okay.
And then you've got the egg house foreman, you got the fish house foreman, that kind of.
Okay, so outside foreman.
He takes care of, like, the port engineers and all whatever's outside the boats.
Outside
beach gang
of a building.
Yeah.
So like instead of being like inside. Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. He's the guy that checks out everything like that. He takes care of the beach gang and launching the boats, or the port engineers and the fixing the boats. And he was also a carpenter too. So he would oversee the carpenters and their projects.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So where does the what's the order of like hierarchy for the cannery when you're thinking about jobs?
Let's see, superintendent, foremans, and then you've got the cookhouse, and let's see, you got the machinists, and because you had your separate machinists, you had the blue room for the office, you know, the superintendent and the higher ups. You had the machinists, and that was where I ate, and the carpenters and all those, and the foremans. And then you had the whole mess hall, which was everybody else.
How is it that you were able to eat with the machinists? Like office counted as that?
Yeah, it was part of, you know, you had to be back a certain time. You go there. The kids, sometimes they didn't have to go back to work, you know, depending on how busy it was that time of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the fishermen, they'd eat also with the cannery.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then after a while, when it got really busy, they'd have to have the cannery crew eat first, and the fishermen would come later, like a half an hour later.
So in your van driving, was it usually cannery workers you were picking up, or were there some like really surprising visitors over the years?
There wasn't too many surprising visitors. I'd have the QC guy would come in. His name's Walt Cawthorn. That was Becky's dad. He oversaw all the quality control for the cannery for Alaska Packers. He went to other canneries and check on things. So he'd fly in every so often. And then they had, sometimes we'd have spotter pilots, but that was a little later than 79. They would be there for herring and spot herring. There was some accidents and stuff, I remember. And one time I picked up one of those spotter pilots, and he really stunk. But it was because he picked up a dead walrus on the way up. Because I go, man, this guy, he hasn't had a shower in a while, you know. But it ended up, he finally volunteered some information after the silence in the van, you know, and told me what happened. He says, it was really rotten. I says, yeah, I could smell it. And then just the cannery kids, they come in and they have their, you know, their boom box and stuff. And then the next thing you know, you got the whole van bouncing away, you know, playing music and stuff coming down the road. And it usually was like that going home, too, when they were leaving. But I haven't had too many surprise visits, you know. Nobody famous that I can remember, you know.
So when you moved into the laundry, how was the laundry organized? Like, how many people worked there? What were their jobs? Was there, like, a head laundry person?
Yes, yeah.
Could you describe that, please?
Let's see. We had Shirley's sister-in-law, Shelly. She worked there.
And what's Shelly Zimmon?
Shelly, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Her dad used to work for FAA Davis. So so that's how she was here. And then she married Clyde, Junior's brother. And then I think they live in Anchorage or Wasilla or something like that now. And there was a couple other gals. When I first got there, there was all the different gals that I never really worked with, you know. And then over the years, there was a rotation of people, but it was always Shirley. She was the main gal. And then me, and then whoever else happened to, we could hire. Now it's Jeannie Stewart, and she's awesome. She's one of my best friends. I really like her. And we spend many winters together, her and her boyfriend. But that's it, you know. I can't think of anybody else. Then we get the cannery kids when they weren't busy. We tried to get them to do some cleaning too, but it didn't work very well because they didn't like to. They'd go up to the bunkhouse and sit in the common room and not do anything but just gab. You know, you catch them doing that. But we didn't get too many good workers that way. In fact, some of the guys worked better than girls when it came to cleaning. Mm.
So you moved into the laundry initially, it sounds like, because there wasn't enough space for all the packages.
Right, and I was never there to be a receptionist.
Okay.
So that was the main thing. Nobody in the front room to tell people where to go, and they couldn't tell anybody what they needed because the desk was empty most of the time.
So how is it that you then came to do laundry duties too?
Well, I helped do books, help paperwork and stuff like that when I was in the office, whatever I could, do. And I did forget, there was one little room when you first entered that office, and that was where the fish clerk did all this fish, only young guy, and he did all the fish tickets. Mm. He logged in all the fish tickets. Mm, okay. So, but I don't know. So they just had me, I'm not real busy, when it's at the beginning. So instead of just sitting there doing little paperworks here and there, they're always busy in the laundry. There's always things to get ready. So we had little laundry packets we all had, with the sheets and towels and everything. So when people came, you just gave them that whole, group of stuff and have them write their name, check out, that kind of thing. And then we had fishermen when they came in. We did their clothing. We would do their laundry, and they'd pay us for it. And we did sleeping bags when the big machine would be going, when the steam got on. So everybody would bring all their big stuff. Even some of the village people would, they'd pay us. But
could you describe the laundry building?
You walk in, there was a big steam dryer on the left, and the kitchen, or like a big laundry sink type thing, and then a big extractor, and then the big barrel washer, and then we had a line. We only had a couple washers and dryers, but then after a while it increased, and then as years went on, we got tables, bigger tables, and folding tables and that kind of stuff. But there was a big bedroom off to one side, and that's where I moved into. Hmm. And so that worked out real well because I was there, the van was parked outside, and whenever I needed to, I just walk out and zoom down the road I went, or down the cannery or whatever.
Was that the first year that you did that?
No. Okay. Oh, the first year in the laundry, yeah.
When did you transition to the laundry?
Oh, in 81, I think it was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was, it had been 81 because I was in the office for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that was nice because it helped them, the laundry gals, out a lot, and it helped me out because I kept busy and I like that. So one time I was too busy. One time Shirley was, her sister, it was a strike year. Her sister got killed on the road, bad car accident. She, there was a bike or something in the middle of the road, and she swerved and she rolled her Jeep and she died. And she just had a baby too. And Shirley was pregnant. And she miscarried. And so she had to leave work. And that year, my husband didn't have a permit. His dad sold the permit out from under him, drip permit. And so Gary kept him on as carpenter all summer, which helped us immensely. But I was going through some anxieties because of all the stuff that was going on. And I was by myself in the laundry, all by myself. I had to take care of everything and drive. So they tried to help with cannery kids and stuff, but it was middle, getting to be the middle of the season. So it took me a while to get over that anxiety thing. It was a lot of going to the clinic, sitting there, you know, blood pressure, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. trying to get it. And my husband says, quit if, you know, you can't handle it, you know. You got to make yourself feel right about it. So, mm-hmm. and he says, just, but then after a while, it got straight in my head. Got to go with the flow. Just try not to, you know, overthink things, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and it'll work out. So after that, it was fine. But that one summer was very hectic.
What summer was that?
I think it was like 82 or 83. I can't even recall what the first, it was the first time I ever seen it. Where they had a strike because mm. the price was low. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so they had a big gathering on the beach road going down to the set nets and stuff and block people from going fishing and stuff like that. And sometimes you get to be a big party kind of thing. And so, but I never went. I never knew what was going on because I wasn't a set netter. I didn't fish. So, and then there's usually, you know, you got all the fish boats that don't fish, but you'll see this, the other ones they call scabs go out there and, boy. And I know, you know, when I started set netting, I found out that when you go, when you're a scab, people don't forget. And this one family down the beach, they got picked on all the time. It was and you never saw anybody do it. You know, like spray paint their truck or cut their running lines or something like that. But it happens. It's weird. No, I never did any scabbing or anything like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that the fishermen deserve a better price. Mm-hmm. You know, just from being the fishermen and watching what they have to do and what they have to buy just to bring the cannery the fish.
How was that to work for the cannery and to understand that side of the operation, but then to be sympathetic with the strikers? Could you talk about a bit about that?
Well, it's only because my husband was a fisherman, a drifter, and I didn't understand it for, you know, at the beginning because there was no strike. I can't even recall when the first one was. But I know in 92, 91, I think it was, there was a strike. And it was I think that's when Triton came in, just before that. And it was not good. I felt there was a lot of issues that didn't get addressed. And there, a lot of times, they'll just tell them to leave, go find another market, you know. But that all of them are on cahoots, you know, they all know what the price is going to be. And for some reason, the more fish there is, the less money they want to give. And it's, you know, more work, you know, and they can't keep up with it. It's really hard to figure out their side of the story, especially when they've got the middleman where they, when they sell the fish, you go to the market, you see $12, $15 for a fillet of fish, and you're getting a dollar, you know. Now, I think the highest I ever got seen was $2.50 for the fishermen, but there wasn't a lot of fish. But and then the next year, it turned to a dollar, and there was twice as much fish.
Was that 1988? 88. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what the job description of a laundry lady or laundry person.
Well, usually first thing could come in, well, coffee, no. And then we have, we just figure out what we're going to do. You know, every day is a bunkhouse change day. And the cannery kids come in and during lunchtime and change their sheets. And that's usually about, and same with the fishermen. And then, but the other bunkhouses, like the machinist, the foreman shack, superintendents, every one of them has a day that we go in and change their sheets. And then every day we go and clean bathrooms. And that's for all bunkhouses, everybody. And then there's other people that do the cannery bathrooms, usually the people that work in the fish house somewhere. Somebody's designated to do that. At least that's the way I understood it, because I never did them. And that, just do laundry. People, like I said, we did fishermen's clothes. We made packets ready for everybody. And there was a lot of sheets. Did orders, stocking, you know, because you got mass laundry soaps and all that kind of stuff. And then you had to make sure all the bunkhouses had all their supplies. And that way they could do all their stuff. But other than that, it was just everyday wash, 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 you know. Mm-hmm. So,
what about the cannery crew's laundry? How did they?
They have that? Every bunkhouse has a washer and dryer. Only one washer and dryer, so you're really having to keep things moving if they're there, you know. And then one or two washers and dryers. But, you know, sometimes they have issues and they can't use them. And then we finally, one year, they built out of the Filipino mess hall that sat vacant. They made that into a fisherman's wash house type thing where they had showers and laundry.
Do you remember when that was?
Gosh, that was probably 88, probably in the 80s, late 80s, mm-hmm. I'd say. Mm-hmm. You know, all the stuff, all the dishes and pans and everything got taken out and made into a big laundry. They really needed it.
Yes. Was the Filipino mess hall empty when you started?
Yes.
So
yes.
The cannery had been integrated by the time you started?
Yes, as far as I know. I can't recall that thing ever going. Maybe my first year, but I don't remember going.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
When was it that you married Bill?
81.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you started in 79,
uh-huh.
And 2 years later, you married a Naknek local.
Yep, my husband. He's been here since he was a kid. You know, his dad was the winter watchman up at Diamond J, and then also his mom and dad met down in Ugashik when his dad was fishing in a sailboat, and she worked in a cookhouse. And there was a cannery, Wingard, I think it was, ran by Wingard. I'm not really sure what company. But they, for some reason, my husband said something about they used the APA sailboats out of Pilot Point. That's where they stored them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I have some pictures of the conversions that they were also, you know, using for fishing. Mm.
So was it Bill then that convinced you to come back after your first year and to continue at South Naknek? Or how did that happen?
I kept
on going to different places.
Yeah. And... Well, yeah, it was Bill. Because, you know, after I was only there 3 weeks and the boyfriend on the tender was out on the hook. And so there wasn't too much love lost there, you know. I just told him what happened and that was it, you know. And he had a wandering eye all the time anyway. And I wanted it, so it didn't bother me. And my mom, she's always wondered about marrying a fisherman because her dad was a fisherman and her mom always told her never marry a fisherman. And so she didn't, but her dad was a fisherman.
And is your mother from Japan? Okay.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And back in the war, I think his boat got taken by the Russians. Hmm. So, but they lived in Hokkaido. Hmm. And her family still lives there. I'd say half of them are gone. But she's got a couple sisters still. But she probably won't travel again back that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's pretty old right now. But Bill was the one that made me come back. So we started living together right after that season, you know, and...
In Washington? Did you say, okay.
Yeah, in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd come back up, and then after a while, we we would stay later, and Gary would let us stay in the girls' bunkhouse. And he did projects around, I'm not really sure, sometimes he went hunting, berry picking, you know, we did all that. And we were building a cabin down the beach and start building. And then we ended up buying a house after a while. In 86, we bought a house.
In South Neck Neck, yeah. Or Neck Neck?
In South Neck Neck.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The little 1932 Sears and Roebuck kit house. Mm-hmm. That lived, and it was, the pit was right after, you know, you come up from the cannery, the pit was there, the bar, and the old bar. And then a big building, old building in between. And then there was a little field, and then it was the little house. And, in fact, one of the fishermen's wives that came up to the cannery to visit her husband, she was a painter, and she painted our house. Mm. And so I've got her painting at the house, and I really like it. She was a very nice lady, Melba. And after a while, she would be like the house mother at the bunkhouse. Mm. It was nice. She was a really nice lady. And not sure if they still fish, but they had a grandson that always come up. Would be Melba and her husband, Ed, and then son, Ed Jr., and then Randy. Mm. So they were real nice.
So after you married Bill, did you both live in the laundry bedroom? Or
no, he still had his bunkhouse, and I still had mine, you know. Mm. 'Cause, and then, yeah, we kept bunkhouses. You know?
So even though you were married, you could not share a room?
No. We just, you know, back and forth. You know? And you got the boat. So, and then after that, well, when he quit fishing, I mean, when his father sold the permit out from under him, we found one in the village that we could use on a transfer. And it was for a hardship. It was through a point system. Back in the day, I guess, if you bought so many licenses, like crew licenses and gear licenses and all that, that you accrued points with the entry commission, and you could get a permit for no money, you know. And so that's how he got his set net, and that's how his dad got his permit. Well, he could have got his gillnet permit too, but it was always promised to him, permit. So, and then somehow he wanted to sell the permit, but he gave Bill the boat, which didn't work very well without a permit. So one of our friends in the village found one for us and helped us, you know, administrated it for us. And there was a couple times where couple years where it was not there, because we come back in the summertime and the permit would be gone because they gambled it, you know, put it up for a poker game or something, and or somebody talked her into leasing it to her. But those two times that she had that happen, or we had that happen to us, she never got paid. So. And she said that once the entry commission figured out if it was going to be given to her, because it was her son, he was applying for it, and he drowned. But the entry commission let her use that as a hardship because she had no income. So she got her 25% right off the top, no expenses, and and she was happy, you know. But she was a drinker, and towards the end, when we were waiting and thought that was the year that she was going to sell it to us, her boyfriend killed her, stabbed her. And so that was the end of that permit. And so just kind of like telling him maybe can't go drifting, you know, and it was a lot more expensive to go than set net. So I gave him back the set net permit, and he went set netting after that.
So you had the set net permit, though.
Yeah.
Where did you fish?
Down at Johnson Hill. We have a cabin down there.
Mm-hmm.
And he built it out of one of the buildings that was falling down at Diamond O. And Gary gave us one of the buildings to tear down. So one fall, we spent all fall hauling lumber out and stuff. We had a winch on our truck, and we, my husband was, learned a lot from his dad, because his dad was a pile buck, and about pile driving and using winch lines and blocking tackles and all that kind of stuff to be able to make it to where you could, you don't need a lot of equipment. You just need to know how to rig those blocks up to move the stuff to your advantage and not have to break your back, you know. And we had a big flatbed, and we'd haul it down the beach. And it was, you know, 11 miles down that beach and over four creeks and playing with the tide, too, to boot. And the cabin, there was a cabin when we first got there. And then we come back the next spring, and it was gone. The whole thing was gone. And found out that Cliff Johnson drug it to Diamond O Hill, or they call it Dead Man's Hill. And that's where it stayed. And Carl Zimmern ended up buying it.
Is this the one that you had built?
We hadn't built it.
Okay.
This was the original one. Okay. Mm-hmm. But so we had to build it then. And so my husband started building that one. But it's quite a deal because it's along the creek, and then you got to go up the hill. And there was, we heard there was an old fish and game cabin there a long time ago. And down below, near the creek, there's a bank there. And we found all sorts of bottles and stuff. Like there was a little cabin or something stuck there. And so we found all sorts of bottles and stuff there. But I know there's some history down that way. You know, reindeer herders. I heard about one of the guys, his dad used to have a gold sluice down there, you know. And I don't know if they ever found anything. I like going down the beach. It's fun.
So what was the first year that you were set netting?
In 88.
Okay. And how did you balance fishing with your work in the laundry?
Well, my girlfriends were nice enough to help me out. And they would, one would take over the driving and the other one would do the mail. And a lot of times, you know, the kids were already in everybody's here in the cannery, so there wasn't a lot of going out to the airport, but there was a lot of mail and a lot of laundry, and it was a little tight, but the, you know, everybody made it work. And whenever I, you know, was off fishing, then I'd go right back to work. You know, I don't care if it was day or night. I just say, go home, I'm taking over, you know.
So how would that practically work? Like, you'd set your net, and then you'd go back to work, or just...
No, I had to... couldn't do it that way. You had to stay there and pick the net. You can't just leave, because you never know how much fish you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep that net clean. So we just stay down there till it was done. And then I'd haul my fish. Well, at that time, I was selling to Bumblebee. Because they had trucks that would come. And then after a while, Trident would take fish, set net fish. But you had to bring it to the cannery. Well, 11 miles down the beach, you know, and if you get a lot of fish, you can't do that. I tried it. I think I took 3,000 or 4,000 pounds, and it was all we could do. And then the tide was there again. So it got to be really hard. And then also a lot of wear and tear on the truck. Mm-hmm. Where the Bumblebee had those big, like, army truck things, like what AGS has, Alaska General Seafers, the same type of truck. And they'd come and pick them up. And they also had issues. Sometimes you'd be stuck down there, and you'd throw all your fish in a tote because they weren't there yet, but you had to get them out of the skiff. And you're sitting there waiting, and they don't come. And the tide is going out, and then the tide's coming back. If you don't get that fish up out of the tide line, So sometimes you're moving those fish again up to a higher ground. And then you got the bears to worry about. So it was ongoing. But then after a while, you know, Bumblebee quit their operation over there. And then that was the end of that. That's when we moved over here.
So you no longer were set netting at that point, or?
No, we moved over to the NACIC side.
Okay.
Because there was no work hardly or anything, so.
So you moved your fishing operation as well over
yes.
to here? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was too hard to live here and move over there back and forth, and so we're thinking about going back over there, but,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
we're just, right now, we're still in transition, still.
So all summer long, you would then spend some days doing set network and some days...
Yeah.
Or gill network, and some days at the office. At the laundry,
yeah.
doing
mm-hmm.
laundry work.
Mm-hmm.
How were you paid if you were working in the office of the laundry? Because would you like clock in, clock out at the mm-hmm. end of the day?
We had time books.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so did each person keep their own time book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so you yeah. just...
And then you hand in a time book.
So could you describe that? Like, would you hand it in every 2 weeks or... How did payment happen?
He handed it in weekly. I think he tore out the whites and kept the copies, you know,
okay.
in a book. It was a book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it worked.
I see. So then you were able to collect overtime,
mm-hmm.
even though you weren't on the canning line necessarily, but you were working
right.
with
it. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
And sometimes I get an agreement with Gary where I'd be on call. So I'd get paid while I was waiting. Because, I mean... If you knew people were coming or whatever, I mean, it's just like you got to sit there and wait. Might as well be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he didn't care if I was doing anything, you know,
mm-hmm.
just pretty easy going that way. But I kept busy most of the time.
So how long did you continue to work doing the laundry / office work, van work? When did you stop?
Oh, gosh. Well, that year that they had the strike in the 90s, you know, that's when we moved over because Gary didn't like me fishing, and which I understand. It was a conflict in the job. And then Trident, my husband was at a meeting, and everybody, all the fishermen got together, and they were all talking and stuff. And they brought out some proposals. My husband said something, and Chuck Bunder didn't like it. So... He wanted us out now. He wanted him out now. And Gary talked him into waiting till the end of the season. Because, I mean, we were already in debt, right? So you make him leave now, then what? You know, I'm not paying you, you know, type of thing. Or something like that. But, no, he let us stay till the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got, you know, when you leave, you get a separation notice for unemployment and all that. And so mine says, Mary will no longer fish during working hours. So that was my indication to time to go. That was the end of the Alaska Packers experience, you know.
And what year do you think that was?
I thought it was like 91.
Okay.
You know, because mm-hmm. in 92, I have pictures of being at Bumblebee in 92. So, and they allowed me to go to fishing. I'd come up in the springtime and open all the bunkhouses up, help with the laundry lady, or wherever. I even helped in the mess hall. And I did the bunkhouses, did the cleaning like I usually did. And then they started putting me in the kitchen, in the store. And I really liked working in the store, stocking and all the people coming in and buying stuff. And when fishing got close to being ready, you know, like June, usually June 5th or something, we'll stop working and start getting ready for fishing.
Mm.
So, and then in the fall time, I'd go back again and close up all the bunkhouses. Everybody be gone. I'd just be in the winter watchman there and make sure all the sheets and everything were out of the bunkhouses, all the garbage. Make sure everything, you know, got winterized, or if there was anything wrong, I'd tell the winter watchman. And that's it. And I got to come and go as I wanted anytime. It didn't have to be all in 1 week, you know, every day. I just came when I wanted to come, you know.
When did you start doing that?
In the 90s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were there for quite a while too. But when they quit, I don't know if we were here. We came over here in 2001. So my husband had a job as the foreman at the dock. And I was hoping that was going to work out. I got a job at Penn Air. And he started in April, and I started in May. And then I worked for Penn Air for 10 years. Mm. And the dock job didn't work out for him. And so he ended up still worked for HUD off and on. Mm-hmm. He did some HUD houses over on this side, renovations and stuff like that, remodels. And that worked out pretty good. And then you got a chance to go to the SAVIC and get trained. So there's all that, you know, stuff going on. So he got his building maintenance and repair, and, you know, we take odds and ends courses, you know, mm-hmm. if it pertained for fishing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So.
And you continue to fish through all of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you still?
Yep. Mm-hmm. We still do. Mm-hmm. So we're still undecided. We're getting older. We're getting a little tired. It's hard to find a good fishing partner. And we get along pretty good fishing. We fished a little bit by together when we were working at Bumblebee. And because it was hard when we had those strike years, and when we had In River on the south side, it back in those days, it was the drifters and the set netters fishing at the same time. Now in the past, just recently, they did set netter only and drifters only, and it was way safer. It was really scary to go fishing back then, mm-hmm. and trying to find sites, you're fighting with everybody, mm-hmm. and you see the true side of a lot of people and wonder, you know why they're like that, because they're not like that normally. But I didn't like fishing in river. And then you can't guarantee anything for your fishing partners, you know. You can bring them up and house them, feed them, but you can't tell them what you're going to get paid when you don't know yourself. I mean, this is the only place that I've ever seen where you come to work and you don't know what you're going to get. I mean, when you get a job, you know what you're going to get paid.
Because the price isn't established.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that, you know, base price, dollar. Mm. Started a dollar. I mean, look at, everything's expanded. Everything's gotten a bit more expensive. But they haven't gone with the fish, you know. So, I mean, even back in the sailboat days, I think the prices weren't, you know, they were kind of in conjunction. I'm not really sure. Yeah. Was it a dollar a fish, or was it, so what would that make it, 20 cents a pound?
Were you working for NN when Trident purchased the cannery?
Yes.
Could you talk about the change from APA to Trident?
Nobody seemed to change as far as people. I mean, you know, the people in the office or the workers. It just seemed like it's just the name change, because it also changed beforehand.
Could you talk about that a bit?
They changed to ConAgra. I couldn't tell you exact years or anything like that, but ConAgra came in 1 year, and then Sea Alaska before Trident. And then I don't know if they were affiliated all with Del Monte, because they were also affiliated with Alaska Packers. And it just seemed like the name changed, but you know, maybe the payroll thing changed, but that's it. You know, once in a while we'll see the higher-ups from them, the ConAgra person. He was an interesting person. I didn't get along with him. But the other guys, Sea Alaska, that's when they started getting the helicopters and stuff, you know, and flying the fish and flying parts out to the boats. I mean, they had awesome service, you know. You break down, they would medevac a part to the boat or to the tender.
Who would?
The company.
Trident? Or,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or not Trident. Sea Alaska. Or oh. I think it started with Sea Alaska.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because I know that I'm pretty sure that guy used to fly around it. But Trident, they also did. They had three or four different helicopter pilots that I remember. And then after that, we left. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what mm-hmm. happened after that.
So it sounds like you were at the NN Cannery for like 13, 14 years?
I think it was at least 12.
Okay.
At least mm-hmm. 12 years.
Mm-hmm. And during those 12 years, what are some big changes or shifts that you noticed with the workforce?
I know that they had a shift in the Filipino workforce at one point because, well, one thing was drugs and really long hours. I don't know, there's just some weird things were going on at that time, I noticed. And then they were worried about the mail. And so I had to be, towards the end, when they were starting to leave, I remember one group was really concerned about their boxes that they were getting. And I didn't know nothing about it. I never even thought about it, you know, until the cops came up and got involved, you know. And so after that, I'm not sure if they still have that kind of big crew like they used to. But back in the old days, you had your Filipino foreman, and I know that those kids, sometimes they had to pay the foreman out of their wage something. And then I heard some, you know, they had poker games, and sometimes some of those people lost their whole summers, you know, and they still had to work to pay it, you know. It was strange. Something totally that I'm not used to. But you don't see it if you're not living there. Mm. So this is things I heard. Mm. So I don't know if they're true or super true or if it's just scuttle or what. Mm. But it's like mafia almost, you know. You know. So I'm sure that's, it's hard to say. I know one guy, it seemed like he was working 24 hours. So I can't see how they can work 24 hours. Mm-hmm. You go bonky after 24 hours. So the girls, I don't know, girls and fishermen, they have that kind of deal. And then being right next to the bar, that has a lot of influence on the workers. And other than that, the workforce, it still kept going, but the people changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you noticed some of the things. And as you get older, you just don't get into the stuff that those guys get into, you know. So I just stay right in my little laundry area.
Mm-hmm. What about changes at the cannery, to the buildings, to the process?
Well, they did have some changes in the fish house. They did a big fiberglass job. My husband was part of that. Him and the one foreman, carpenter foreman, and the ice house thing that came in. That was a big step. You know, they had the big ice house for the fish, keep them colder, and then they had. Just changes on the dock, you know, just like renovations to the crane and all that. But the boats kept getting bigger, and they were getting harder to lift. And it's a cannery; it's old wood. They give way. I went through driving the van. I went through a plank, And it was, they got it fixed, but it was interesting because it broke right through and popped that van up there, kind of like hydraulicked me over, you know. And luckily it didn't damage anything. But I used to drive through the thing, at, you know, the cannery, the whole, the dock area and everything, because I deliver mail and I deliver to the stock room and just, and picked up those boxes from QC because they're out in front by the beach gang boss, beach gang area. And so I made my rounds through there all the time with the van, even to the cookhouse, going down that little narrow chute. And so, because we hauled laundry down there and stuff, because we didn't have carts. We don't have the little Cushmans or anything like that. So if we didn't have me to drive it down, then it's haul them in those big baskets, and they're heavy, you know. Two or three loads of sheets is heavy, especially
those wicker baskets.
Yeah, those big wicker baskets. So, and you got to be careful with the laundry when you put those things, the hot laundry, into the wicker baskets, because they can burst into flames.
Did you see that happen ever?
One time I saw, this was before I got into the laundry, I saw a basket, a burning basket, come crashing out of a window in the laundry. Because they took it from the steam dryer, because you don't need to, the steam dryer is very hot, so you don't keep it in there longer than 30 minutes. And even a propane dryer, you don't. You got to check it. But all those sheets and stuff, they get so hot, and they put it into that basket, and that basket caught on fire, and they just threw it out the window.
So tell me about the, because, you know, you go to the cannery, and there are fire hoses everywhere. Would you have fire drills?
You know, I never saw a fire drill.
Hmm.
You know, and we never had any. You know how in school you had the fire drills? I don't recall a fire drill, you know, or any kind of emergency thing. You know, like if you had an earthquake or if something.
Mm-hmm.
So they just, I guess they just assumed you'd know what to do.
Where to go.
Have your fire extinguisher here, you know, so, and we got lots of water. But, you know, when you're working in chemicals and all that, that's a big thing, too, you know, because you can't throw water on some chemicals. And, but, and you know, like the fiberglassing that goes on down at the, for the boats and all that kind of stuff, that's high volatile, you know, very volatile. Volatile. So. Mm-hmm. And how about working in the cookhouse? That all those, all that oil heat that's going on, those big cook stoves and stuff like that. But they seem to manage, and I've never seen them on fire, which is good. Okay. So
are there some memories or some things about the cannery that you think are important for us to know and to? And to document?
Well, I know that there's a lot of times where you make a lot of good friends. You meet as you go along, you know. And there's sometimes you get some experiences, some good, some bad. And it happens everywhere, you know, not just cannery. But it's just like a stepping stone in life to me, you know. Something to keep busy and make some money. And it's not a normal job, but I like it the way it is, you know. I like the seasonal work. And I don't like it being broke during the winter time, but you know, if there's longer season, it'd be a little bit better. But they, as soon as the red season goes, then they don't want to stick around for silvers or any of that. And those are just as good a fish, you know. But there's that gap. There's always like 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with those people for 2 or 3 weeks? So it's hard to keep them busy. That's when they always have problems, you know. Mm-hmm. They take their money and they go out to the bar because there's nothing else to do, unless they're nature people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to go out and, you know, shoot guns and stuff like that, go target practicing, or just go look at the bears at the dump, you know, or go down to the beach, go clam digging, because they have clams right there off of Diamond O. Lots of rocks in the beach there, but there are clams there. And there's, like, there's over on this side. And just general, I like just going out in the tundra, you know, because it's so pretty, all the wildflowers and all that. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely an experience. And I'd recommend it to anybody, you know, right out of school. You know, find your niche type thing. Mm-hmm. See if, because I know that a lot of people, when they come up here, they either like it or they don't like it. Usually there's not that middle ground. So you always want to be back here. Mm-hmm. And in the springtime, it's just like when I was not living here year-round, you'd be antsy. March would come and you just want to get ready. And I don't know how it would feel if I never came back, you know. So I just don't know. I haven't figured that one out yet. Mm-hmm. Came close this year. Mm-hmm. But only because of family, you know. Have to take care of mom. Mm-hmm. But
was there anything else you want to share about cannery life, or anything at all?
I can't think of anything. I've got, I know I have lots more things and lots more pictures I could show you, but they're all down in Washington. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are. And I think that's about it for now.
Well, thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much. I'm going to stop this.